Hello, everybody. I just finishing up a little mental health walk after my lunch, and I was doing some thinking about this podcast and just how grateful and fortunate I am to be able to talk about these things and to have people in my life that are fluent, I guess is a good word. I met Sarah, Nina, and Bob through our training with Living Well, Dying Well. And, you know, I think a certain kind of person does walk into doing this work, but they definitely have given us a lot of tools to engage actively, compassionately, good listening skills. And these are things that you have to practice, and we don't really have much in the way of opportunity to practice. So, yeah, I was just kind of having a thought about this, our first little jaunt into doing podcasts, and I'm quite happy with it. I think I could probably attempt to perfect it and, you know, harp on about, did I do this right? Did I do that right? But comparing myself to other shows that have, you know, dozens or if not hundreds of different episodes under their belts, I think isn't fair. So I hope you agree. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed the conversation. It was fun for the four of us just to chat. Usually when we get together, it's in a much more structured way with learning and with outcomes and things like that. So it was fun just to be able to sit down and talk and explore different topics that, you know, we don't really get to explore without any sort of time constraints. So I hope you enjoy, and thank you so much for listening. Bye.
I just want to see your shadow next to mine, sailing over pavement with our two outlines. I like to see the shape you're in from time to time. I just want to see your shadow next to mine.
All right, there we go. We are recording. Well, thank you. I'd love to know, what do you think of the name, Talking with Mortals?
It's intriguing.
Yeah? Yeah, no, I don't know if I'm fully settled on it.
I think it's great because it doesn't actually say, you know, this is yet another death pod. Not, I'm saying there's lots, but it doesn't actually say this is another death podcast. It could be anything, couldn't it?
You know what?
Is that the wrong answer?
Maybe yet another death podcast might be a funny one to do. I'm going off on a tangent. I haven't even introduced anybody. Sorry, I've never done this before. My name is Erin. I have started this podcast, and the Good Morning Society, and I am joined by three very dear friends. We have Sarah and Bob and Nina. You're behind my camera, but I can see you. So I don't know. I don't want to do formal introductions. So what I would love to do, I should also say that we all met because we are doing our end of life doula training together. And we have kind of worked our way through modules here and there and joined, and we are currently in the same module together. So when I asked if anybody wanted to help me do this, these kind people stepped up and said yes. So today, I think what we're trying to do is just sort of start talking about death in a way that is approachable to everybody. So not experts, not other doulas, not anybody who works in hospice care or palliative. For everybody, because everybody will deal with it at some point, and it's not something that we talk about, and it's easier to talk about when you hear other people talk, and we're kind of good at that. So I think what I'll do is just open up with a question. What was the deciding thing that brought you to doing the doula training? And anybody can start.
That's a deathly silence, excuse me.
I I think it was like, it's a bit strong to say it was a calling, because I wouldn't call it a calling, but every time I thought, oh, I'm really interested in this area, I'm really drawn to it, and all the reasons, I'd then not forget about it, but think, oh, there's nothing out there. And then something else would happen around death, a conversation with a friend, I'd hear something on the radio. And I think I'm being drawn back to that. And I think it was that being pulled back every time I thought, no, this is just not necessarily for me. Mm. Does that resonate with anyone?
Yeah,
it does with me for sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just I'd experienced a number of deaths that were tricky. Many of them are, and I knew I didn't need or want counselling, but I wanted to talk about death, and people don't. Or I didn't know how to start a conversation about it. And I heard about it and did the foundation and haven't looked back. And they start off saying it's not therapy. But it is. But it's life therapy, not, you know, it's not anything more than that. That's, mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Bob, how about you? Oh, you're muted.
I think for me, it was that I had a friend in the States who, because at the time, you know, I came from it from a different way. So at the time I was teaching mindfulness, another friend in the States who helped two of her friends who were at an end of life with practice, and they both had quite deep practice. So I was quite inspired by the idea of using mindfulness practices to help and support somebody. And I think at the time, you know, I could teach the mindfulness, but I knew nothing about death and dying. And my sister at the time was doing her birth doula training and came across an article of on end of life. And I thought, oh, brilliant. You know, this is interesting because this would bridge my knowledge and gap about end of life. Hence, you know, I started the journey into end of life doula. And what's been surprising for me is that it's just opened up a whole world of things in terms of end of life, you know, like advanced care plan, LPA, and all those things that I never really thought about. So, so yeah, that's how
Does your sister still do, is she a birth doula?
I think she's not actively doing birth doula, but she has supported people.
It's kind of funny. It's like
in birth
doula, a family business, like from cradle to grave.
Great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sort of how it should be. I was just interested in something that you said, Nina, around you wanted to to talk more about how to have conversations about death. And whilst I was the same, it was more because I had experienced the death of a loved one, my brother, but through that, the tragedy of it, and I realized I was actually very, very comfortable with it, which is quite a contradiction. And that's the thing that stayed with me. But picking up on what you were saying, Nina, is I was thinking, well, where are the other people who are comfortable about this? And I remember going forward when someone had been bereaved or someone was going through something similar to what I'd been. I think, well, actually, how would have I felt if that person had kept quiet? How would I felt if we'd not talked about it? So it's that back to being your first client. I was hugely aware that there's a role out there for talking about this and being with and alongside people at the end of life, but I didn't know that this doula role existed at the time. So it's just the same thing but slightly different.
That definitely resonates, Sarah, because you know it was very much that I wanted and to talk about it. You know, death's another part of life, and it was finding people who you could sit comfortably with and have those conversations that I've started to have now outside of the doula circle.
Well, that brings up a question for me. How have the people in your lives responded to you becoming more death positive and perhaps bringing it up more or being more comfortable about it? Have you had pushback? Have you had people kind of shy away? Or have you become sort of the beacon, the go-to in your circle?
I don't know if we're all struggling with modesty or yeah, absolutely.
I think partially we're not used to like just being able to talk because we usually we're like
yeah 100% 100%. I've found it a really nice experience. People do want to talk, but they want somebody who feels confident and comfortable to help those conversations. And I think, you know, that's the same with anything that you don't necessarily know the narrative around, is you seek somebody who's comfortable and confident and competent. And so I would definitely say friends and family and work colleagues. I mean, I still get people coming up to me going, about death. But that's okay. Oh, we're all on a journey. That's fine. It's fine. We're all in a different place. And I love that because that's the door being pushed open. And it's like, come in.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can talk about it. And guess what? We don't have to whisper.
Yeah. If you whisper, then it won't happen.
Yeah. I know.
It's never going to happen. it's interesting because with my immediate family, there is a bit of eye rolling now because any opportunity to weave it back into family conversation. But actually, that's really nice because that's the sort of the strength of it, that at first that I'm fully supportive and they are fascinated. But at the same time, here we go. You know, Mum is about to, talk about death again. I actually have a death basket, which is called the death basket in the house. Any books I'm reading about death just live in one basket and they get carried around the house. Oh, she's coming downstairs with a death basket.
I have a death cupboard and nobody goes in it.
I think my family, my wife, my son, they're open about death, and I think ever since Robin was young, probably around five, or I can't remember the age, but when I was interested in end-of-life doula work and death doula, me and Robin would have conversations about that. So he's very comfortable with things, and also we live in the countryside, so when I took him to infant school one time, and we saw this hedgehog that was squished in the road, he was curious, so we went and have a look at the squished hedgehog, and you know there are dead birds carrion, and you know, so he's kind of interest, so much so, I mean he loves collecting stones and sticks, but he's also interested in collecting bones. So my wife's not too happy when he brings dead bones back and says, make sure you sterilize that. So, but I think for him, because, you know, it's out in the countryside and he sees things that die. So he knows that's part of the natural cycle. So, yes, I would say my family, you know, are comfortable, and we often talk about the subject.
You might have a budding taxidermist there.
Actually, it's funny because one of the things I do is gardening, and sometimes, you know, when I go to clients, there's like a dead jackdaw that had been freshly killed by a kestrel that, you know, so I would put it in the box and bring it back for him, and then he'll take it to the allotment and then kind of investigate
it. Well, it's something that, so you're all parents, right? I think in various conversations. Okay. I'm not. And it's something that's actually been on my mind because I've been thinking about how it is that we discover death and like how we learn about it. And because I've never been a parent, I don't know what it's like to try and teach a child what, you know, the idea of mortality and how do you prepare them for the inevitability of you leaving? And like, is it something that you'd sort of, you shield them from until it's impossible to hide it, like a grandparent or a pet dies? Like, I have no concept of how parents handle this, and I would love to know, like, any experiences.
I think that's really interesting, because as Bob was talking, I was thinking about his experience with young children, his own young children. I was thinking, now, having done this course and having brought to my death much more, I feel much more literate in talking about it. Would I handle conversations I had about death with my children when they were really young in a different way? And would I have talked to them more about it? And that was what was coming up for me when Bob said that. But in answer to your question, it's a really good one, Erin. I'm not sure quite how I dealt with it. I'm not sure I can answer it. Just sort of process. But I would definitely do it differently now.
Mm. Yeah, you were nodding a lot when I was saying that.
Well, because I related a lot to what Bob said. So I find children are much more comfortable with these subjects now. So when my children were growing up, my daughter in particular had an absolute fascination with bones and skulls in particular and whatever. So it was very much just about the, you know, the objectiveness of something and what happens to it. And she then went on to do her master's in forensic art. And for her final piece, she created a life-size model, a replication of a body at 168 hours. So this was supposed to be a tool to help photography students who were doing forensics and whatever. But in the end of year show, what fascinated me was there was a warning sign had to go up to say that there was material, and it was my daughter's, material that might be upsetting and you might want to consider whether you want to go in with a child. The children that came in absolutely loved it. Adults were kind of a bit like, oh, I don't know, because there's the insects and the decay and all of this. Kids were just completely factual. It's like, oh, what's this? And what happens then? And why is her skin like this? And so I think, you know, just the factual without the emotion, it is a really helpful way for some children. And pets are invaluable. Most parents I know had a hamster so that they'd go through death with something that they weren't that attached to. And certainly I'll never forget my daughter coming up to me going, oh, he's nearly dead now. Can we get another one? okay, that's a bit too factual. But it's normalising. I mean, I mean that trivially, and of course it wasn't like that with, you know, when other people, when people passed away.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's, I try
I
to do
think
a little bit of a search
for that.
I try to do a search, like, just for, like, parenting books or something like that for an insight, and pretty much every single one that wasn't, like, purely psychological was hooked to a bereavement that the child would, you know, like, grandpa's died, what does this mean? Or, you know, pets have died, what does this mean? And, like, using that as a way in. No, so thank you for that. I didn't, I even for myself, like, I had hamsters, I remember the hamster deaths and fish and, you know, all of that. But I think the first real death that I remember was my grandfather. And, like, we've kind of talked in various sessions, but, like, I don't have a great relationship with my mother. But even so, because this has been on my mind, when I spoke to her the other day, I asked her, like, what do you remember about teaching me about death? And the way that she relayed the story, it I mean, because she can do no wrong, it made her sound like she had done everything right and I was the one that wasn't ready. So the way that she described it was when my grandfather was in the hospital, that I was pressed up against the door, crawling out of my skin, trying to leave. And in my mind, I'm going, well, gee, that sounds like a kid who hasn't been prepared for what she's being shown. But to my mom, she was like, oh, no, that's just the way that you were. You weren't ready for it. And I'm like, I was 8 years old. I was. Anyway. So it's interesting to me, like, even now, as this movement grows, as people are becoming more and more comfortable talking about death, I'm interested to see how that translates into parenting and, you know, bringing the next generations into it, because that's vital for the progression of it, isn't it?
Absolutely. Sorry, Bob.
I was just going to say, in terms of Robin, and I mean, what Nina said is very true, that a lot of the time children are pretty comfortable with death, and they've got a curiosity about it, and it's kind of fostering that curiosity. And of course, you need to make sure they're comfortable with it as well. Because, I mean, one, when I was working as a doula with somebody, supporting them, you know, Robin would, I also did her garden as well. So Robin would come along with me and then we'll be doing her garden. And he would interact with her. And I remember, I said to him, you know, so-and-so died, and I was there, you know, for her death. And he would, you know, he was thinking about things. And then, you know, he said a very insightful thing to me. He said, well, I suppose he's gone back to nature, oh, wow. Or she's gone back to nature. And I thought, wow. I thought that, you know, wow, that's very, very insightful. So I think sometimes children really surprise us in things. I remember when my father-in-law, when he died, and I was going to take Robin to see his body in the care home, because I thought, oh, you know, as a end-of-life doula, great opportunity for Robin to see a dead body. And of course, my wife said, you know, you probably want to just check with Robin first to see, you know. And she had a point, because, you know, I thought, okay, you know, this would be a great opportunity. But, you know, what she said was, just check, Robin, is this comfortable? And I asked him, you know, are you okay if we go and see, you know, Grandad? And he says, yeah, that's fine. So we went to the care home, and then we sat with the body. And of course, it's a new experience for him, and he's just looking you know, and he wasn't sure. So just having, seeing me that I'm comfortable, I think that's the other thing, is when they see somebody that's comfortable with a dead body, rather than freaking out, you know, we are kind of modeling for them of how to relate to the dead. So yeah, those were my thoughts. I was laughing a bit when Nina was talking about pets. I was a terrible elder brother when I was younger, and I always had crazy ideas, and my sister had these terrapins. So I decided to rearrange some of the rocks, and unfortunately there were two terrapins, one of them got stuck and then it died. I know, it was terrible. My sister was pretty upset, and I thought, oh, I had a great idea. Why don't we have a funeral,
obviously,
for this terrapin? So, you know, we took it into the back garden. We had the procession.
Oh, cremation!
I put the terrapin in the fire, and then you could hear this hiss. And then there was this foul smell that came out. And my poor sister, you know, I don't think she's ever forgiven me, but, you know, as kids, you've got these crazy ideas. So that was what was.
That's a parenting guide in how not to do it as a sibling.
I was going to say, quite seriously, that is quite a theme with children and pets, or even wildlife that dies in the garden, and they initiated that idea of wanting to have some sort of funeral. But I wasn't expecting you to it to be a cremation when you said it. Oh.
That's true. Like, children have this, like, desire for ritualizing it and making it special, don't they? Like, it's almost like an innate thing. Because I remember doing that with, like, goldfish, even. We played a little song when I flushed the first goldfish down the toilet. Like, and it's like we have this, like, built-in need to make it something meaningful and memorable, but maybe not cooking a turtle.
You might have something there, Erin. Themes for songs for flushing goldfish.
Just perhaps a little bit more on the serious side. I don't think there's any right way, and we're all obviously influenced by the way we're brought up, whether you go with it or you go against it, whatever. I was brought up by a Victorian mum and dad, and excluded from my grandma's funeral, who I loved very much. And I recognised in later years that really damaged me. And they did it for the right reasons. And when my father died, I made sure that if my children were comfortable, putting it briefly, that if they were comfortable, that, you know, they should come. This was going to be a celebration of Grandma's life and whatever one might have. But I went on then to make the mistake of assuming that they would want to be passive in that. And my son would have, he was little, but my daughter was about 10. And I asked another relative if they would like to, I don't know, sing a song or something, playing to their talents. And my daughter said, I want to participate. I want to read a poem for Granddad. And so I think it's that, you know, they're always surprising about what they do want to do. And that's not to force people into anything. But I made an assumption based on my own experiences, you know, thought I'd push things into a new realm and then completely missed the opportunity to offer her to participate. And it was really positive, you know, really positive.
Yeah, I think it, and that's, finish a sentence. It's important to remember that even just the experience that you have to start with doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to want to continue doing that. Like, for instance, I have seen, you know, bodies in funeral homes and stuff. I don't think I want to do that again if there's another opportunity, just because for me personally, seeing a body that's been embalmed does not look right to me. It's not that I have an issue with dead bodies. It's that it doesn't look natural to me. And it sits, it's almost this weird uncanny valley where it's almost them, but it's not them. But I have been with people when they've died, and I've seen them and they look like them. They just look like them, but dead. And it's almost like my brain can absorb that better than whatever it is that happens in funeral homes. So I think it's just remembering that what worked once won't necessarily work for the next one, and just always checking in. That idea of consent, like we always talk about consent, but it's also kind of consenting with yourself, like, is this right for me right now, given everything that I've been through up to this point? Yes, no, okay, and then you can move on. I think that's the thing that people kind of, they don't give enough value to, is there's not a one and done sort of answer to these things. And then it's a very fluid, you constantly have to be checking in with yourself, constantly like check in with everybody else. We live in a society where we want the answer and we just stick to it, and then that's it forever and ever. Amen. And it's not, that's not at all for this. Yeah.
Yes, because I was wondering about that little bit, without sort of getting into different people's beliefs and all of that, but some of that comes into it because the few times that I have been with a dead body or seen a dead body, not, I don't mean immediately after death, but then later in the Chapel of Rest or whatever, I find it comforting because what I see there is it's not the person, even if they look like the person. So I'm more comforted myself by the fact that it's not the person. Mm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, 100%.
Which is sort of the opposite. But then I've spoken to many people who have sat there and even a week after have held their person's hand and felt the real presence of the person. Whereas if I've felt any presence, it's coming from something, somewhere else. It's in the air. It's and I don't even know whether that's a belief. It's just what I feel in that moment. And I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this, but I was wondering about, you know, Bob's had that experience of being with your son, was it your father-in-law? Yeah. And
yeah.
You know, without prying into that, did you leave that open for him to how he would feel about, was this actually granddad? Do you see what I mean?
I don't think that question came up. I suppose I am assuming here that he saw the dead body and that was the body of granddad.
But that's terrific, because that's just a very factual, that's, you know, I'm overcomplicating. I think that's just really fantastic what you did. And you know, I'm now thinking, why do I complicate everything so much? You just summed that up in one lovely sentence. What a good way, yeah.
But I think it gets complicated because of all of the pieces that we're carrying, like our own beliefs and the things we've been taught and what culture tells us. And most of the time those things are conflicting, and it, even in the given situation, maybe it feels right to do one thing, but then your brain is going, no, children shouldn't be here. Or, you know, like it's because we don't talk about it, because it's not something that is openly discussed. I think we all kind of walk around feeling like I've done it wrong, even if you've done it right, because you have no bearing of what right or wrong or normal or, you know what I mean? Like we, like most social creatures, we don't have anything to measure against anymore when it comes to this.
If I could go back to Sarah's point, about beliefs. Now, if Robin had said, you know, what do you think of his, do you think he's still alive somewhere, or, you know, this is, if it's his spirit, you know, somewhere, then I would probably have more of a discussion with him about what he thinks, and then discussion about what I think. So it would probably be more of a dialogue of exploration rather than something, you know, this is how it is, etc. You know, his body is here, but his spirit's all around. So I think it would be probably more of a dialogue and exploration of what he thinks, and then discussion about that. But I think, you know, if he did bring that up, you know, it's certainly a worthwhile topic to explore.
Yeah.
No, do you want to adopt me?
You know, thinking. Pardon?
You're looking for a middle-aged daughter.
But I think it's wonderful because what you're saying, it's like you had so much. I mean, yes, your wife did say, you know, you need to check in with him. But because the dialogue you'd already had with him, and everything you talked about, it just felt like such a natural, that's my reading of what you're saying, such a natural progression and such a wonderful opportunity for him to experience that at an early age. But perhaps without the what had happened beforehand and the way he'd shown interest and curiosity, also because of what you do, it might not have led naturally to that. So it's back to what you say, Erin. There's no right or wrong, is there?
Mm. Yeah. Rather than me throwing a topic out, is there anything that anybody here would like to discuss that you feel like you haven't been able to bring up in any of our other discussions before? Could be anything.
I just missed the beginning of what you said there, Erin. Just the first few words. Do you mind repeating it?
No, I was just saying that rather than me throwing out another question, is there anything that anybody would like to talk about? Like maybe just a thought that you brought into here or something that hasn't come up that you'd like to talk about? And I also want to know...
That's come up.
Oh, sorry. Oh. I just want to note that we are all very comfortable with silences because of the training that we have gone through and just our experience with sitting. So if there are long silences, nothing is wrong. We're just very comfortable sitting and thinking. But I interrupted you. Go ahead.
There were just a couple of things that links into something you said, Nina, and also something you said, Erin, about that experience of talking to our friends and our circle, if you like. But something, I mean, we do touch on it because you have to adapt to whoever you're with and what's appropriate. But sometimes when I'm listening to people maybe on the radio or people who are talking about death, every now and again I think, oh, there is a time where perhaps we have a responsibility to not be too overzealous with it. We have to meet people where they are. And every now and again, I hear someone say something. I think I'm completely comfortable with it. But whoa, yes, I do get excited by the conversation. But if I go around leaping about saying, you know, you've got to do this and everyone must do their advanced planning, you know, it can be very off-putting, and I'm not sure whether that's something we explore that much, but maybe we do just by our general conversations about how do you talk to other people? How do you bring up the subject of death?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to anyone?
So a term was coming up in my head. You know how we had the rogue doula? And now yes. We've got the evangelical doula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is why I don't like using the phrase death positivity, because I think it gets misconstrued.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I like that, Bob. Yeah, that summed it up. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, there is a fine line, isn't it? Isn't there? And sometimes I'm sort of thinking, no, choose your moment, Sarah. Choose your moment.
Yeah, it's something I have to check myself with, because I am quite comfortable talking about it. By nature, I don't tend to get very emotional about death unless it's a pet, and then I lose my ever living mind, for whatever reason. But when it comes to speaking with people who don't normally talk about it, I do try and measure their comfort level. I talk about, so in my mind, I've kind of developed, there's like three different sizes of death. And I see it, because I'm a very visual person, I see it in terms of like topography. So you have death, which is like all in lowercase. And that's just as if we're sort of talking like, oh, I don't know, after they died, I went and, you know, visited Egypt or something like that. So it's a very casual, like it's just sort of a minor point of the sentence or what you're talking about. And then there's death that's capitalized, where it's like, yeah, that happened after he died. And that's kind of the point of the subject, but it's not this big emotive sort of thing. And then there's dead with like all caps. And that's when you're like, he's dead. And like that is, it's everything. Like there is nothing else but that. And I find that people who can't even cope with the lowercase, I don't know how to talk to them yet, to be perfectly honest, because I've always kind of been okay with the lowercase. Does that make any sense to anybody? Like how I just described that, or is it all in my head?
I think that's a brilliant way. But what occurred to me actually, as you were saying, you don't know, you feel you don't know how to talk to people who are deaf in lowercase than that. And a moment ago, I was saying about not, sometimes, you know, you can be overzealous. But it occurred to me then that maybe, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but in the lower capital, the non, you know, the lowercase term, the really just referred to and moving on, maybe we do have a responsibility not to always meet people exactly where they are, to be mindful where they are, but think, well, why is that? Can I prompt something else there? Do they just need someone who will recognize where they are at, but give them the space to explore it and perhaps, you know, put one letter into capitals to use your idea. So I think it's a bit of both, isn't it? We have to be bold at times.
Yeah.
But mindful. Did that sort of make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense to me.
It makes sense to me, but I'm still thinking.
I mean, yeah, it makes sense to me. I'm very mindful that we're not counsellors, but I'm afraid for me, I don't know if I'm afraid, I'm being apologising and not apologising for when I sense that silence, I dive in. I don't mean I go, so come on, you need to talk about death. But I think that, that's the point. I don't worry so much about the person who's going, and he's dead. It's the people who disappear and shrink away. And those are the people who I do invite them to open the door. And I don't think I've had anybody yet say, I don't want to talk about it. They talk about it in different ways, very, very different ways. But, yeah.
It leads me to a question that I wanted to ask, because I think what gets me fired up about it is not just that I think it's a practically good thing and a socially good thing to have these conversations and be more open with aging and dying and death. And I would love to know if you all have had this experience as well. But when I started down this path and started to really embrace the idea of mortality and living with it consciously, my life got better. Like, I used to struggle to feel gratitude. I used to struggle to find the beauty in like small things. And I was really impatient with people. And it's kind of unlocked that little part of me that now has more compassion, and I can see the beauty in mundane things because I know it's scarce and it's finite. And that to me is where I get really a sense of urgency to share it with other people, because I'm like, guys, this exists. Like, it's so easy. Like, you can be happy. You just have to accept you're going to die. That's it. That's all you have to do, which I know sounds ridiculous, but I don't know if that's a universal thing or if that's just a me thing that I'm like, I've found some Zen state, or if that is what happens with people. So I would love to hear if that's just a thing for me, or if you had it too.
I think it's in a different way for me, but I think that that question that comes up a lot when we're talking about how we find out in a doula role about a client or whatever, and the thing that's repeated a lot is, what does a good day look like for you? And that question stays with me all the time, and I found that really useful, not just in the sense of end of life, but by keeping in mind what you've just said. So when there's all noise and stuff going on and you don't know where you're going, then just calming down and saying, what does a good day look like for me? How can I get back to that? Or I might not use that expression with a friend who's going through something, but I'll keep that in mind. And I think that that's my way of exactly what you're saying. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's also when people ask me, you know, they often say, oh, what's it like thinking about death, you know, all this time, you know? And then it's, well, it's not exactly what you're saying. It's not thinking about death. It's thinking about living and how we all want to live. I'm trying not to go into the territory of inspirational quotes and cliches here, but that, you know, what's a good day like for me? And it doesn't have to be the great big bucket list. It's just appreciating what makes me work, or what does it, what's a good day for another person. And that's my take on it. It's the living.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's you know, finding opportunities to have to facilitate those discussions, and with friends and family or people I meet, if it comes up naturally, we would have the discussion around that or about that, rather than me going around knocking on people's door and saying, you know, you know, death is really important. And it could be they're open to it. It could be they'll say, no, go away. So I think for me, it has generally tended to be that I feel people are guided my way to have those type of conversations. And then we have those type of conversations.
I really liked what you said, Erin, and if I sort of understood it really, then yes, that's exactly what I've found, that I feel so much more joyful about everything that can give you joy. Now, as a kid, I was terrified of death. I don't know why, and I was absolutely petrified of it, obsessed with it. And now it's swung right the other way, and it's exactly what Sarah said. The only thing I'm worried about now is not living life well and taking getting to the end of the day and realizing that I bypassed all those mindful opportunities that bring you, you know, huge comfort, joy, whatever personally floats your boat. So I have found it really inspirational being able to have this context, and I know we get, and it's probably part of the culture change for us as well in this country, but of course with the program that we're doing, we're very focused on death, which can put it, and sometimes I feel a bit in a silo with that. But once you come out of that, having to do an assignment or something that keeps you thinking about death for about 48 hours, it's back to it's part of a continuum, whatever. But it's very liberating. I find very liberating.
Mm. That's good. No, thank
liberating.
You.
Liberating is a good word.
It kind of, I agree. Like, I do feel sometimes, even with ourselves, because we know each other through the training, but we don't really spend a lot of time just talking like this, which I love just being able to chat with you all, because I know, you know, bits about you, but we haven't been able to just sitting for an hour or two talking. So it's good to share these feelings and not feel like you're kind of the only one that's experiencing it. And like, you know, I'm happy. If I was the only one, I'd be like, oh, okay, well, I'm glad, but, you know, if I could bottle it and give it to other people, that would be wonderful too. I'm just aware of the time. I am so grateful that you all took the time to sit with me and chat like this. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you listen to other podcasts. Lots of other podcasts have like certain little segments here and there to like break it up. I don't know if I'm going to continue to do this, but I do have these conversation decks that I created. And I think just because we've been talking more about like life and I don't know how, what we get from life or yeah, what we get from life after talking about death. I kind of wanted to maybe take out the deck. So I have the Memento Vivere. So Memento Vivere is what I consider like the opposite of Memento Mori. So Memento Mori is remember that you will die. And Memento Vivere is remember to live. Because if you don't remember that, then the dying is going to sneak up on you. And, you know, so I thought maybe we could just really quick, because these are all sort of questions that are, they're more like introspective and more about like who you are right now. So like your thoughts, beliefs, things like that. So I thought maybe I could just draw some random ones and I will go around. Okay, Sarah, I will start with you just because you were the first one to log in. This is 1, 2, or 3?
2.
Who is one person that you can turn to when everything seems to go wrong?
Is it me who's got to answer that?
Yeah.
Just me?
No. That was a very special silence.
You're all very patient.
you're stalling for time, Sarah. Go on.
And actually, I missed two of the words. Was it who is the a person you can go to when everything seems to be going wrong?
Yes.
Yeah. I sort of want to say all the obvious things, you know, my husband. But actually, I'm starting in line of everything we were just talking about. She waves her hands about excitedly. I'm not in an evangelical way. I'm learning I have to go to myself first now, which I never would have done. And I have to sort it all out a bit more. And I never would have done that. It would have all just gone, blah, 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 and, you know, tears or in extreme cases, or just feeling overloaded. I'm not saying I don't have those feelings anymore, but through where I am in life, including this training, all the discussions I'm having, so I'm starting to realize, yeah, you can sort this out a bit yourself first and then go to best friend or husband.
Love that. Thank you. Good answer.
Blimey.
All right, Nina, you were second. Sorry, Bob, you got the short straw. One or two?
Two.
What would you do differently if you knew no one would judge you?
Oh.
Oh, there was an answer there that just came to mind.
Well, it did, and I don't know whether I take all my clothes off and run down the high street. What
yes.
would I do differently?
Especially in this heat.
I mean, that kind of that epitomizes it, doesn't it? You know, because if I could do that, I could do anything I wanted to.
It's true. It's true. Okay. And Bob.
That is a metaphor, by the way. I don't have a...
we'll hear it in the news. We'll hear in the news. BBC News.
The British are not made for heat over 30 degrees that's, like, outside of Spain. So I think anything we do right now is kind of forgiven. All right. Last but not least.
No, you've actually just got a top on.
But that's true. I mean, you guys, we've not met in person, so you don't even know, like, if I have legs, if I've got, you know, a lower body. Right, so last question. How do you show someone how much they mean to you, Bob?
How do I show someone how much they mean to me? I suppose I tell them I love them.
Simple. Short and sweet. Right. Well, thank you so much.
You got one for you, Erin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What about
hoping you wouldn't?
Come on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You should have one as well, Erin. Yes.
Okay. I was fair. I picked a random one. How has your life changed for the worse in the last 6 months? Well, that's an easy one. I was made redundant from my job of 5 years the same week that my soul kitty died, which you were all, well, I can't remember which module that was, but it was two or three. But yeah, it happened in February. So within a week, a lot of things had changed. But I tend to not see things as good or bad anymore. Or at least I try not to. Because so many things have happened in my life that I considered terrible in the moment. And then I have enough age and perspective that I can look back and be like, actually, that was needed. Or because that happened, I learned this and I am now good at that. So I think I could turn around and say, like, oh, well, I lost my job. I mean, I'm not happy about my cat being dead. That's not great. I really would have preferred to have a few more years with her. But the job, you know, I'm happy I get to try and do this full time and really throw myself into it, because I feel like this is fully what I want to do, what I'm meant to do. So it's not bad, but it could be bad. You know, it's all on how you look at it. So. Okay, well, that is the first episode of Talking with Mortals in the Bag. Thank you, everybody.
Well done, Erin.
All right. Well,
thanks, Erin. Sending you love.
Baby, you know, I just like to talk with you. I just want to go.